Hello again. This is Mrs. English, and today I'm reading to you from the Richmond Latimore translation of Homer's Odyssey. I'm reading from Book 8. Then, when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, Alcinous, the hallowed prince, rose up from his sleeping, and the descendant of Zeus, Odysseus, sacker of cities, rose up, and Alcinous, the hallowed prince, guided them to the Phaeacians' place of assembly, this is to the Agora, the town square, which was built for them by the ships. They went and took their seats on the polished stones together, but Pallas Athena went through the city, likening herself to the herald of wise Alcinous, as she was devising the return of great-hearted Odysseus. She would go, line 10, and stand beside each man and speak a word to him. Come with me, leaders of the Phaeacians and men of council, to the place of assembly, there to find out about the stranger who is new come to the house of wise Alcinous, after wandering on the great sea, and in shape he is like the immortals. So she spoke, and stirred the spirit and strength in each man, and quickly the place of assembly and seats were filled with people who gathered there, and many wondered much as they looked on the wise son of Laertes, Odysseus, and upon him Athena drifted a magical grace about his head and his shoulders, and made him taller for the eye to behold, and thicker, so that he might be loved by all the Phaeacians. So Athena beautified him, and to them might be wonderful and respected, and might accomplish many trials of strength by which the Phaeacians tested Odysseus. But when they were assembled, and all in one place together, line 25, to them now Alcinous spoke forth and addressed them. Hear me, you leaders of the Phaeacians and men of council, while I speak forth what the heart within my breast urges. Here is this stranger, I do not know who he is, come wandering suppliant here to my house from the eastern or western people. Line 30. He urges conveyance, and entreats us for its assurance. So let us, as we have done before, hasten to convey him, for neither has any other man who has come to my house stayed here grieving a long time for the matter of convoy. Come then, let us drag a black ship down to the bright sea, one sailing now for the first time, and have for it a selection from the district of 52 young men who have been the finest before. Then, each man fastening his oar to the oarlock, disembark, then come to my house and make yourselves busy for a present feast, and I will make generous provision for all. I say this to the young men, but also, you other sceptered kings, come to me in my splendid dwelling so we can entertain the stranger guest, this Zenus, in our palace. Let none refuse, and summon also the inspired singer Demodocus, for to him the god gave songs surpassing in power to please. Line 45. Whenever the spirit moves him to singing. So he spoke and led the way, and the others followed as sceptered kings. But a herald went seeking the inspired singer, and also the 52 young men who had been selected went, as he told them, along the beach of the barren salt sea. But when they had come down to the sea, line 50, and where the ship was, they dragged the black ship down to the deeper part of the water, and in the hull, the black hull, set the mast in place, and set sails, and made the oars fast in the leather slings of the oarlocks, all in good order, and hoisted the white sails and set them. 55. They anchored her deep enough in the channel, and then themselves made their way to the great house of wise Alcinous. And the porticos and enclosures and rooms were filled with people assembling. There were many men there, both old and young ones, and for them Alcinous made a sacrifice. 12 sheep, 8 pigs with shining tusks, and 2 drag-footed oxen. These they skinned and prepared and made the lovely feast ready. The herald came near, bringing with him the excellent singer, whom the muse had loved greatly, and gave him both good and evil songs to sing. She reft him of his eyes, this means he was blind, but she gave him the sweet singing art, line 65. Pontanous set a silver-studded chair out for him in the middle of the feasters, propping it against a tall column, and the herald hung the clear lyre on a peg placed over his head, and showed him how to reach up with his hands and take it down, and set beside him a table and a fine basket, and beside him a cup to drink whenever his spirit desired it. They put forth their hands to the good things that lay ready before them. But when they had put away their desire for eating and drinking, the muse stirred the singer to sing the famous actions of men on that venture whose fame goes up into the wide heaven, the quarrel between Odysseus and Peleus' son Achilles, how these once contended at the gods' generous festival with words of violence, so that the lord of men, Agamemnon, was happy in his heart that the best of the Achaeans were quarreling. For so in prophecy Phoebus Apollo had spoken to him in sacred Pytho when he had stepped across the stone doorstep to consult. For now the beginning of evil rolled on, descending on Trojans and on Danaans through the designs of great Zeus. These lines require a bit of explanation. The singer is now going to sing about Troy. Now Odysseus knows that these people who live so far away, the Phaeacians, have heard about him. This mention of a quarrel between Odysseus and Achilles is not one that we read about in the Iliad. It is only cited here in all of Greek literature. Nobody knows what the quarrel is. However, one of my commentaries by Peter Jones speculates that Agamemnon is happy, that's line 78, happy in his heart, happy because the Pythia must have said that Troy would fall when the best of the Greeks quarreled. You see that it mentions the Pythia. He went to sacred Pytho. Apollo spoke to him at Delphi then, where the Pythian priestess was. This is line 80. When he crossed the doorstep and said that when the best of the Achaeans were quarreling, that's when Troy would fall. And thus, Agamemnon is happy because the best of the Achaeans, Odysseus and Achilles in this story, are quarreling. Line 83, back to the story. These things the famous singer sang for them, but Odysseus, taking in his ponderous hands the great mantle dyed in sea purple, drew it over his head and veiled his fine features, shamed for tears running down his face before the Phaeacians. And every time the divine singer would pause in his singing, he would take the mantle away from his head and wipe the tears off, and taking up a two-handled goblet would pour a libation to the gods. Line 90. But every time he began again, and the greatest of the Phaeacians would urge him to sing, since they joyed in his stories, Odysseus would cover his head again and make lamentation. There, shedding tears, he went unnoticed by all the others, but Alcinous alone understood what he did and noticed, since he was sitting next him and heard him groaning heavily. At once he spoke aloud to the oar-loving Phaeacians, "Hear me, you leaders of the Phaeacians and men of council. By this time we have filled our desire for the equal feasting and for the lyre, which is the companion to the generous feast." Line 100. Now let us go outside and make our endeavor in all contests, so that our stranger can tell his friends after he reaches his home by how much we surpass all others in boxing, wrestling, leaping, and speed of our feet for running. So King Alcinous is being a good host. When he sees that this particular song is causing Odysseus to weep, he has another suggestion. Let's go do something else. Line 104. So he spoke and led the way, and the rest went with him. And the herald hung up the clear lyre on its peg, and taking Demodocus by the hand, he led him out of the palace and set him on the star of the way, because Demodocus is blind, where all the other best men of the Phaeacians went to gaze at the contests. They went to the place of assembly, the Agora, with an endless multitude following, and many and excellent young men stood forth. Acronius stood up, and Achialius, and Elatrius, Nautius, and Perminius, and Chialus, and Eretmius, Pontius, and Prorius, Theun, and Anabesinius, Amphilius, son of Pelinius, the son of Tecton, and Euryalus stood up, Nebulus' son, a man like murderous Ares himself, and he was the best of all the Phaeacians in build and beauty, only except for stately Laodamas. The reader in English does not realize that all of these names mentioned, as my commentary tells me, all of these names of the young men are associated with the sea. For example, Acronius means top ship, and Achilles means swift sea. All of these names have something to do with the sea. Also, there stood forth three sons of stately Alcinous, Laodamas and Halius and godlike Clytonius. Line 120. First of all, they held a contest for speed in running, They feet the field strung out from the starting scratch, and all at the same time flew on together, turning up the dust of the plain. Of these, stately Clitunnius was far the best in the running, and was out in front by the length of a furrow for mules ploughing a field, and came back first to the crowd with the rest behind him. Next, these tried each other out in the painful wrestling, and in this Euryalus surpassed all the best among them. In the jump, it was Amphilius who outdid all others, while with the discus, far the best of them, was Elatrius. And in boxing, line 130, it was Alcinous's fine son Laodamas. But after all had enjoyed their hearts with athletic contests, Laodamas, the son of Alcinous, spoke forth among them. "Come, friends, let us ask the stranger if he has skill and knowledge for any kind of contest. In his build he is no mean man, no common man. For the lower legs and thighs he has, and both arms above them, for the massive neck and the great strength, nor is it that he lacks youth, but the crush of many misfortunes has used him hardly. For I say there is no other thing that is worse than the sea is for breaking a man, even though he may be a very strong one." Then in turn Euryalus spoke forth and answered, "Laodamas, this word you spoke was fair and orderly. Go yourself then and say it to him, and invite him to try it." Then, when the excellent son of Alcinous heard this answer, he went and stood in the midst of them, and spoke to Odysseus. Line 145. "Come you also now, father stranger," this is a Zenus, "and try these contests, if you have skill in any. It beseems you to know athletics, for there is no greater glory, no greater kleos, that can befall a man living than what he achieves by speed of his feet or strength of his hands. So come then and try it, and scatter those cares that are on your spirit. Your voyage will not be put off for long, but now already your ship is hauled down to the sea, and your companions are ready." And so this son of Alcinous is telling Odysseus, the ship's all ready. If you lose, we're not going to take back what we said we'd do. Everything's ready to go. You may as well relax and have some fun first. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered him, "Laodamas, why do you all urge me on in mockery to do these things? Cares are more in my mind than games are, who before this have suffered much and had many hardships, and sit here now in the middle of your assembly, longing to go home, entreating your king for this, and all of his people." Here, this is a little awkward, because it isn't exactly polite for the king's son, Laodamas, to challenge a Zenus, to challenge a guest, when the guest is absolutely exhausted and was almost drowned at sea and was in the water for all of those days. Euryalus answered him to his face and spoke to him roughly, "Oh, no, stranger, for I do not see that you are like one versed in contests." "Oh, I see now," says Euryalus, "oh, you're not a man of contests, but rather to one who plies his ways in many locked vessel, master over mariners who are also our men of business, a man who, careful of his cargo and grasping for profits, goes carefully on his way. You do not resemble an athlete." This is quite the slam against poor Odysseus by Euryalus, because merchants were scorned. If you wanted to gain kleos, you went fighting or you went raiding. You did not go trading and selling. Merchants were rather scorned by the heroic crowd. And so, of course, they're pushing Odysseus, saying, "Oh, of course, you don't even look like an athlete. You must be a merchant." Line 165. Then, looking at him darkly, resourceful Odysseus answered, "Friend, that was not well spoken. You seem like one who is reckless. So it is that the gods do not bestow graces in all ways on men, neither in stature nor yet in brains or eloquence. For there is a certain kind of man, less noted for beauty, but the gods put comeliness in his words, and they who look toward him are filled with joy at the sight, and he speaks to them without faltering and winning modesty, and shines among those who are gathered, and people look on him as on a god when he walks in the city. Another, again, in his appearance, is like the immortals, but upon his words there is no grace distilled, as in your case. The appearance is conspicuous, and not a god even would make it otherwise, and yet the mind there is worthless." So Odysseus just shamed this young man and called him brainless. "Now you've stirred up anger deep in the breast within me by this disorderly speaking, and I am not such a new hand at games as you say," line 180, "but always, as I think, I've been among the best when I still had trust in youth and hand strength. Now I am held in evil condition and pain, for I had much to suffer, the wars of men, hard crossing of the big waters. But even so, for all my troubles, I will try your contests, for your word bit in the heart, and you have stirred me by speaking. He spoke, and with mantle still on, sprung up, and laid hold of a discus that was a bigger and thicker one, heavier not by a little than the one the Phaeacians had used for their sport in throwing. He spun, and let this fly from his ponderous hand. Line 190. The stone hummed in the air, and the Phaeacians, men of long oars and famed for seafaring, shrank down against the ground, ducking under the flight of the stone, which, speeding from his hand lightly, overflew the marks of all others. And Athena, likening herself to a man, marked down the cast and spoke and addressed him. Line 195. Even a blind man, friend, would be able to distinguish your mark by feeling for it, since it's not mingled with the common lot, but far before. Have no fear over this contest. No one of the Phaeacians will come up to this mark or pass it. She spoke, and much enduring, great Odysseus rejoiced, happy to find one friendly companion in the assembled company. Line 201. Again he spoke to the Phaeacians, in language more blithe. Now, reach me that mark, young men, and then I will make another throw, as great as this, I think, or one even better. Let any of the rest, whose heart and spirit are urgent for it, come up and try me, since you've irritated me so, either at boxing or wrestling, or in a foot race. I begrudge nothing. Any of the Phaeacians, that is, except Laodamas himself, for he is my host. Who would fight with his friend? Surely any man can be called insensate and good for nothing who in alien company offers to challenge his friend and host in the games. And of course, these are contests, the boxing and wrestling, these are the contests that Odysseus excelled at Patroclus's funeral games. And so he offers up these games first. He knows he will be good at these, and his success in the discus has probably given him some confidence that he still has what it takes to do so. And then these lines, 207, 8, 9, and 210, and 211, Odysseus is very polite. He says, what host would challenge his? What guest would challenge his host? I would never do that. But of course, his host has just challenged his guest. No damages, he damages what is his. No, but I refuse not one of the rest, nor do I scorn him, but I am willing to look in his eyes and be tested against him. I'm not bad in any of the contests where men strive. Line 215. I know well how to handle the polished bow, and would be first to strike any man with an arrow aimed at a company of hostile men, even though many companions were standing close beside me, and all shooting with bows at the enemies. There was Philoctetes alone, who surpassed me in archery, when we Achaeans shot with bows in the Trojan country. This mention of Philoctetes in line 219 is another hint to Odysseus's audience that this is someone important. He's been to Troy. He knows Philoctetes. He has shot arrows with him. This continues to heighten the suspense. Oh my goodness, who is this man who shot with Philoctetes, who knows him, and who was at Troy? He shot when we Achaeans shot with bows in the Trojan country. This man has been to Troy and fought. Line 221. But I will say that I stand far ahead, out ahead of all others, such as are living mortals now and feed on the earth. Only I will not set myself against men of the generations before, not with Heracles nor Eurytus of Oechalia, who set themselves against the immortals with the bow, and therefore great Eurytus died suddenly, nor came to an old age in his own mansions, since Apollo in anger against him killed him, because he had challenged Apollo in archery. I can throw with the spear as far as another casts with an arrow. Only in a foot race, I fear one of the Phaeacians might outpass me. I've been through too much, and shamefully battered on many rough seas, since there could be no orderly training on shipboard. And because of this, my legs have lost their condition. So he spoke, and all of them stayed stricken to silence. Line 235. Only Alcinous spoke up and gave him an answer. My friend, since it is not graceless for you to speak thus among us, but you are willing to show that excellence you are endowed with, and this is arete, his excellence that he is endowed with. Angered because this man came up to you in our assembly and belittled you, in a way no man would properly find fault with your excellence, with your arete, if he knew in his heart how to speak sensibly. So the king is kind of apologizing for these younger men who have offended Odysseus. Line 241. Come then, attend to what I say, so that you can tell it even to some other hero after this, when in your palace you sit at the feasting with your own wife and children beside you, remembering our excellence, our arete, and what Zeus has established as our activities through time from the days of our fathers. For we are not perfect in our boxing, nor yet as wrestlers, but we do run lightly on our feet, and are excellent seamen, and always the feast is dear to us, and the lyre, and dances, and changes of clothing, and our hot baths and beds. Come then, you who among all the Phaeacians are the best dancers, do your dance, so that our guest, after he comes home to his own people, can tell them how far we surpass all others in our seamanship, and the speed of our feet, and dancing and singing. Let someone go quickly and bring Demodocus, his clear-voiced lyre, which must have been set down somewhere in our palace. And so the Phaeacian king, King Alcinous, wants Odysseus to experience the very best dancing and athletics and shipmanship that the Phaeacians have to offer, so that they will receive Kleos, glory, when he goes home and tells other heroes, other people, about their fame in these activities. Line 256. So godlike Alcinous spoke, and the herald rose up to bring the hallowed lyre out of the king's house. And now stewards of the course stood up, nine in all of them, chosen out of the people, who on every occasion set in good order the grounds for games. And they smoothed the dancing floor, and set right all the ground, and the herald came bringing with him the clear lyre for Demodocus, who moved into the middle, and about him stood forth young men in the first of their youth, well trained in dancing, and beat the wonderful dancing floor with their feet. Odysseus gazed on the twinkling of their feet, his heart full of wonder. Line 266. Demodocus struck the lyre and began singing well the story about the love of Ares and sweet Garland and Aphrodite, how they first lay together in the house of Hephaestus secretly. He gave her much and fouled the marriage in bed of the Lord Hephaestus. To him there came as messenger Helios, the son, who had seen them lying together in love. Hephaestus, when he had heard the heart-sore story of it, went on his way to his smithy, heart turbulent with hard sorrows, and set the great anvil upon its stand, and hammered out fastenings that could not be slipped or broken to hold them fixed in position. That was line 275. Demodocus is now singing a story about when Aphrodite and Hephaestus were married. Of course, in the Iliad, Hephaestus was married to Charis, but here, apparently in this story anyway, Hephaestus is married to Aphrodite, who doesn't even know how to be faithful, and Aphrodite is having an affair with Ares, and Helios, the god of the sun god, who sees everything that the sun could shine on, that's why he's called all-seeing, it does not mean everywhere, whatever the sun is shining on, he can see, and he tells him, Hephaestus, Ares and Aphrodite, your wife, are having an affair. And so Hephaestus goes to his shop, and he's making a special net that will trap Ares and Aphrodite in Hephaestus's bed, so that they can be caught and shamed publicly. That's this story. Continuing at 276. Now when, in his anger against Ares, he had made this treacherous snare, he went to his chamber where his own dear bed lay, and spun his fastenings around the posts from every direction, while many more were suspended overhead from the roof beams, thin like spider webs, which not even one of the blessed gods could see. He had fashioned it to be very deceptive, but when he had spun about the bedstead all of his treacherous device, he started for Lemnos, the strong-founded citadel, which, of all territories on earth, was far dearest to him. Line 285. Nor did Ares of the Golden Reins keep a blind watch on him, as he saw Hephaestus, the glorious smith, go away, but then he took his course, so he entered the house of glorious Hephaestus, lusting after the love of sweet garlanded Cytherea. Now, Aphrodite, when she was born, a little discursion here, when she was born, after her birth from the sea foam, that was in Hesiod's Theogony in section 192, she's born from the sea foam, and she came ashore at Cythera, spelled with a C or a K. Thus, she has this epithet, Cytherea. Also, she landed at the island of Cyprus, or Cyprus, with a C or a K, and that is why she is also called Cyprian, or Cyprian. She is called both of these epithets. Continuing at 289. She had lately come in from the house of her father, the powerful son of Cronos, and sat there when Ares entered the house. Then he took her by the hand and spoke to her and named her, saying, "Come, my dear, let us take our way to the bed and lie there, for Hephaestus is no longer hereabouts. But by this time he must have come to Lemnos and the wild-spoken Sintians." In other words, Ares comes to the home of Aphrodite and says, "I just saw your husband Hephaestus leave. Come, this is our time alone." Line 295. So he spoke, and she was well pleased to sleep with him. These two went to bed and slept there, and all about them were bending the artful bonds that had been forged by subtle Hephaestus, so neither of them could stir a limb or get up. And now they saw the truth, and there was no longer a way out for them. They're trapped. Line 300. The glorious smith of the strong arms came and stood near Hephaestus. He had turned back on his way before ever reaching the Lemnian country, for Helios had kept watch for him and told him the story. He took his way back to his own house, heart grieved within him, and stood there in the forecourt with the savage anger upon him, and gave out a terrible cry and called to all the immortals, "Father Zeus, and all you other blessed immortal gods, come here to see a ridiculous sight. No seemly matter how Aphrodite, daughter of Zeus, forever holds me in little favor, but she loves ruinous Ares because he's handsome and goes sound on his feet, while I'm mishappen from birth, and for this I hold no other responsible but my own father and mother, and I wish they had never got me. Now look and see where these two have gone to bed and lie there in love together. I'm sickened when I look at them, and yet I think they will not go on lying thus even for a little, much though they are in love. I think they will have no wish for sleeping, but then my fastenings and my snare will contain them until her father pays back in full all my gifts of courtship I paid out into his hand for the sake of this terrible daughter. The girl is beautiful indeed, but she is intemperate." So he spoke, line 321. And the gods gathered to the house with the brazen floor. Poseidon came. You realize he called for Zeus, but Poseidon came? Think about it. For Demodocus's audience, these are people who worship Poseidon. They travel over the sea. Poseidon is their special god. And when they need help, when someone has to solve something or resolve conflict, it's going to be Poseidon. Poseidon came, the shaker of the earth, and the kindly Hermes came, and the lord who works from afar, Apollo. But the female gods remained each at her own home for modesty. They don't want to look. The gods, the givers of good things, stood there in the forecourt, and among the blessed immortals, uncontrollable laughter went up as they saw the handiwork of subtle Hephaestus. So the gods and goddesses think it is hysterical that Ares and Aphrodite are caught here in this trap of Hephaestus, in Hephaestus's bed, and there they are, to be publicly laughed at. Uncontrollable laughter went up as they saw the handiwork of subtle Hephaestus, and thus they would speak to each other, each looking at the god next him. "No virtue in bad dealings. See, the slow one, Hephaestus, has overtaken the swift, as now slow Hephaestus has overtaken Ares, swiftest of all the gods on Olympus, by artifice, though he was lame, and Ares must pay the adulterer's damage." This was the way of the gods as they conversed with each other. But the lord Apollo, son of Zeus, said a word to Hermes. "Hermes, son of Zeus, guide and giver of good things, tell me, would you, caught tight in these strong fastenings, be willing to sleep in bed by the side of Aphrodite the Golden?" So Apollo says to Hermes, "Even if you knew you were going to be trapped like this, would you be willing to be caught?" Then in turn, the courier Argiophontes, Hermes, answered, "Lord who strikes from afar, Apollo, I wish it could only be, and there could be thrice this number of endless fastenings, and all you gods could be looking on, and all the goddesses, and still I would sleep by the side of Aphrodite the Golden." He spoke, and there was laughter among the immortals, only there was no laughter for Poseidon. But he kept entreating Hephaestus, line 345, the famous craftsman, asking him to set Ares free, and spoke aloud to him and addressed him in winged words. "Let him go, and I guarantee he will pay whatever you ask, all that is approved among the immortal deities." Then in turn, the renowned smith of the strong arms answered, "Shaker of the earth, Poseidon, do not urge this on me. The business of wretches is wretched, even in guarantee-giving. To what could I hold you among the immortal gods if Ares were to go off, avoiding both his debt and his bondage?" Then in turn, Poseidon, shaker of the earth, answered, line 355, "Hephaestus, If Ares goes off and escapes, not paying anything he may owe you, then I myself will pay it. Then in turn the renowned smith of the strong arms, Hephaestus, answered, It cannot be, and it is not right that I should deny you. So mighty Hephaestus spoke and undid the fastenings. Straight away the two of them, when they were set free of the fastening, though it was so strong, sprang up, and Ares took his way thraceward, remember he is worshipped by the Thracians, while she, Aphrodite, lover of laughter, went back to Paphos on Cyprus, where she was born, where lies her sacred precinct and her smoky altar. And there the graces bathed her and anointed her with ambrosial oil, such as abounds for the gods who are everlasting, and put delightful clothing about her, a wonder to look on. And so the lovers go off in opposite directions. So the famous singer sang his song, and Odysseus enjoyed it in his heart as he listened, as did the others there, Phaeacians, men of the long oar, famed for seafaring. Line 370. Then Alcinous asked Halius and Laodamas to dance all by themselves, since there was none to challenge them. These two, after they had taken up in their hands the ball, a beautiful thing, red, which Polybus, the skillful craftsman, had made them, one of them, bending far back, would throw it up to the shadowy clouds, and the other, going high off the ground, would easily catch it again before his feet came back to the ground. Then, after they had played their game with the ball thrown upward, these two performed a dance on the generous earth, with rapid interchange of position, and the rest of the young men standing about the field stamped out the time, and a great sound rose up. Then great Odysseus spoke a word to Alcinous, saying, "Oh, great Alcinous, preeminent among all people, truly, as you boasted, your people were the best dancers, so it is done before me. Wonder takes me as I look on them." Line 385. He spoke, and Alcinous, the hallowed king, was pleased, and at once he spoke aloud to the oar-loving Phaeacians. "Hear me, leaders of the Phaeacians and men of council. I think this stranger, this Zenus, is a man of discretion. Therefore, come, let us give him a gift of friendship, as is becoming." They're going to exchange the Nea. "For here are 12 who are marked out as kings in our country with power, and they act as leaders, and I myself am the 13th. Then let each of you who are such contribute a well-washed robe." So each of these 12 princes plus Alcinous is going to contribute a well-washed robe and a tunic and a talent of precious gold. Then we shall assemble it all together so that our stranger may have it in his hands and be pleased as he goes in to supper. But Euryalus shall make amends to him with a spoken word and a gift for having spoken out of due measure. And so Euryalus is going to have to apologize and give him a special present. So he spoke, and they all approved what he said and urged it, and each one sent his herald away to bring the gifts back. Line 400. Then Euryalus spoke in his turn and answered Alcinous, "O great Alcinous, preeminent among all people, certainly I will make amends to our guest, as you urge me. I will give him this sword, which is all bronze, but the handle on it is silver, and there is a scabbard of fresh sawn ivory cut in rings to hold it. He will find that it is of great value." So he spoke, and put the sword with the nails, which would be like bolts or nail heads, with the nails of silver into his hands, and spoke to him and addressed him in winged words, "Farewell, father and stranger, and if any word was let slip that was improper, may the storm winds catch it and carry it off, and the gods grant you safe homecoming to your own country and wife, since here, far from your own people, you must be suffering." Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered him, "Farewell also to you, dear friend," so now they've made up, "and may the gods grant you prosperity. May you never miss this sword you have given me now as a gift and made amends to me with words spoken, and so all is forgiven." Line 416. So he spoke and slung the sword with the nails of silver over his shoulder. The sun went down, and the glorious presence came in, carried by the proud heralds of Alcinous, and these surpassingly lovely gifts, the sons of Alcinous took over and set them down beside their respected mother. Now Alcinous, line 421, the hallowed king, was their leader, and all of them went into the house and sat on their high thrones. Thereupon the king Alcinous said to Arete, "Come, wife, bring out a magnificent coffer, the best one you have, and in it yourself lay a robe that is newly washed, and a tunic, then warms a brazen cauldron over the fire and heat water for this man, so he may bathe and then see all set out in order the presents which the stately Phaeacians brought here to give him, and rejoice in the feast and in listening to the song of the singer. I myself make him a present of this surpassingly lovely golden cup, so that all his days he may remember me as he makes libation at home to Zeus and the other immortals. So he spoke, and Arete, going to her maidservants, told them to set the great cauldron over the fire as quickly as might be, and they set the tripod for the bath water over the blazing fire, and poured in the water and gathered kindling and lit it. The fire worked on the belly of the cauldron, the water heated. Meanwhile, Arete brought out from her chamber the splendid chest for the stranger, and in it laid the beautiful presents, the clothing and the gold which the Phaeacians had given, and she herself put in a robe and a handsome tunic, and spoke to the stranger and addressed him in winged words, saying, "You yourself must see to the cover and nimbly fasten a knot, so none may break in, while on your journey you rest in a pleasant sleep as you go your ways in the black ship." Line 446. When long-suffering great Odysseus had heard this, straightway he made the covering tight upon it and fastened it nimbly with an intricate knot, whose knowledge the lady Circe had taught him. So she taught him some type of a special Boy Scout knot. Then the housekeeper told him without delay to enter the tub for his bath, and he, with joy in his heart, looked on the hot water, for he had not been used to be so looked after in the time since he had left the house of fair-haired Calypso, though in that time he had been looked after as if he were truly a god. When the maids had bathed him and anointed him with oil, they put a lovely mantle and a tunic about him, and he stepped from the bath and went to join the men at their wine-drinking. Then Nausicaa, and of course this is the daughter, the princess, with the god's loveliness on her, stood beside the pillar that supported the roof with its joinery, and gazed upon Odysseus with all her eyes, and admired him, and spoke to him aloud, and addressed him in winged words, saying, "Goodbye, stranger, and think of me sometimes when you are back at home, how I was the first you owed your life to." So poor Nausicaa was very sorry to see Odysseus leave. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, "Nausicaa, daughter of great-hearted Alcinous," line 465, "even so may Zeus, high thundering husband of Hera, grant me to reach my house and see my day of homecoming. So even when I am there, I will pray for you, as to a goddess, all the days of my life. For, maiden, my life was your gift." He spoke, and went to sit on a chair by the king Alcinous, line 470. And now they were serving out the portions and mixing the wine as the herald came near, bringing with him the excellent singer Demodocus, prized among the people, and set a chair for him in the middle of the feasters, propping it against a tall column. Resourceful Odysseus called the herald over and spoke to him, but first he cut a piece from the loin of the pig with shining teeth, with most of the meat left on, and edged with rich fat. "Here, herald, take this piece of meat to Demodocus, so that he may eat, and I, though a sorry man, embrace him. For with all peoples upon the earth, singers are entitled to be cherished, and to their share of respect, since the muse has taught them her own way, and since she loves all the company of singers." As a side note, it's very interesting that we are listening to a story that a bard is telling, who is thought to be inspired by the muse, and our bard is telling the story of another bard telling the story, and he is teaching his audience the proper way to treat a bard, which is to give him the choicest meats. So he spoke, and the herald took the portion and placed it in the hands of the hero Demodocus, who received it happily. They put forth their hands to the good things that lay ready before them. But when they had put away their desire for eating and drinking, Odysseus the resourceful spoke to Demodocus, saying, "Demodocus, above all mortals beside, I prize you. Surely the muse, Zeus's daughter, or else Apollo, has taught you, for all too right following the tale you sing the Achaeans venture, all they did and had done to them, all the sufferings of these Achaeans, as if you had been there yourself or heard it from one who was. Come to another part of the story." Now, a side note here, Odysseus praises the bard and says, "Wow, you sing just like you were there, or you must have heard it from someone who was there. What does this tell the Phaeacians? Oh my goodness, Odysseus must have been there to speak like this." Come to another part of the story. Sing us the wooden horse which Epeius made with Athena helping. The stratagem great Odysseus filled once with men and brought it to the upper city, line 495, and it was these men who sacked Ilion. So what story does Odysseus want to hear? He wants to hear the story of the Trojan horse. Why would he want to hear this particular story, even if it makes him cry? Because in this particular story, he gets all the credit. Remember, back in book 1, lines 1 and 2, tell me, muse of the man of many ways, Odysseus, who was driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. The horse was Odysseus's idea. Thus, Odysseus gets the credit for the sack of Troy. And that is why, way up here in book 8, he now asks for the story of the great horse. He wants to hear the story where he will shine and impress these Phaeacians. Line 496. If you can tell me the course of all these things as they happened, I will speak of you before all mankind and tell them how freely the goddess gave you the magical gift of singing. Okay, so Odysseus says to Demodocus, if you can sing this and do it well, I'm going to tell everybody how good you are. That means Odysseus is letting the audience know, the Phaeacian audience know, that he knows whether this bard will tell it correctly or not. He spoke, and the singer, stirred by the goddess, began and showed them his song. Line 500, beginning from where the Argives boarded their well-benched ships and sailed away after setting fire to their shelters. But already all these others who were with famous Odysseus were sitting hidden in the horse in the place where the Trojans assembled, for the Trojans themselves had dragged it up to the height of the city, and now it was standing there, and the Trojans seated around it talked endlessly, and three ways of thought found favor. So they have three ideas of what to do with this horse that they've drug inside the wall. We, Homer's audience, are hearing about the Trojan horse as a flashback as Odysseus tells the Phaeacians about the Trojan horse. He tells us the Trojans had three things they thought of doing. Three ways, line 506, of thought found favor. Either to take the pitiless bronze to it and hack open the hollow horse, or to drag it to the cliff's edge and topple it over, or let it stand where it was as a dedication to blandish the gods, and this way was to be the end of it, seeing that the city was destined to be destroyed when it had inside the great horse made of wood, with all the best of Argives sitting within and bearing death and doom for the Trojans. He sang then how the songs of sons of the Achaeans left their hollow hiding place and streamed from the horse and sacked the city. And he sang how one and another fought through the steep citadel, and how in particular Odysseus went with godlike Menelaus, like Ares, to find the house of Deiphobus. Deiphobus was the leader of the Trojans after Hector died. He was another prince of Troy, another son of Priam and Hecuba. So the singer tells us that Odysseus and Menelaus went to find the house of this next leader after Hector, Deiphobus. And there, he said, he endured the grimmest fighting that ever he had, but won it there too, with great-hearted Athena aiding. And now Odysseus's audience, the Phaeacians, even realize not only was he responsible for allowing the Greeks to sack Troy, but he had the help of a god. Line 521. So the famous singer sang his tale, but Odysseus melted, and from under his eyes the tears ran down, drenching his cheek. And what was it like when Odysseus cried? As a woman weeps, lying over the body of her dear husband, who fell fighting for her city and people as he tried to beat off the pitiless day from city and children, sees him dying and gasping for breath, and winding her body about him, she cries high and shrill, while the men behind her, hitting her with their spear butts on the back and the shoulders, force her up and lead her away into slavery to have hard work and sorrow, and her cheeks are racked with pitiful weeping. Such were the pitiful tears Odysseus shed from under his brows, but they went unnoticed by all the others. But Alcinous alone understood what he did and noticed, since he was sitting next to him and heard him groaning heavily. Line 535. At once he spoke aloud to the ore-loving Phaeacians. Hear me, you leaders of the Phaeacians and men of council. Let Demodocus now give over his loud lyre playing. Let's stop this story. Since it cannot be that he pleases all alike with this song, ever since we ate our supper and the divine singer began, our guest has never ceased since then his sorry lament. Great sorrow must have come on his heart, surely. But let him hold now, so that all of us, guest receivers and guest alike, may enjoy ourselves. Okay, don't spoil the party. This is the better way, seeing that all this has been done for the sake of our honored guest, this escort, these loving gifts we give him for friendship. For any man whose wits have hold on the slightest achievement, his suppliant and guest is as good as a brother to him. So do not keep hiding now, with crafty purposes, the truth of what I ask you. It is better to speak out. And now King Alcinous says to Odysseus, line 550, tell me the name by which your mother and father called you in that place, and how the rest who live in the city about you call you. No one among all the peoples, neither base man nor noble, is altogether nameless, once he's been born, but always his parents, as soon as they bring him forth, put upon him a name. So King Alcinous says to Odysseus, who are you? Line 555, tell me your land, your neighborhood, and your city, so that our ships, straining with their own purpose, can carry you there. For there are no steersmen among the Phaeacians, neither are there any steering oars for them, such as other ships have, but the ships themselves understand men's thoughts and purposes, and they know all the cities of men and all their fertile fields, and with greatest speed they cross the gulf of the salt sea, huddled under a mist and cloud, nor is there ever any fear that they may suffer damage or come to destruction. Okay? Tell us where you're from. Our ships always get you there. We never worry about suffering damage or being destroyed. This is foreshadowing what will happen when Poseidon, their patron god, finds out that they have aided his worst enemy, Odysseus. Yet this I have heard once upon a time from my father, Nausithous, who said it, and told me how Poseidon would yet be angry with us, because we are to convey without hurt to all men. He said that one day, as a well-made ship of Phaeacian men came back from a convoy on the misty face of the water, he would stun it and pile a great mountain over our city to hide it. So the old man spoke, and the god might either bring it to pass, or it might be left undone, as the god's heart pleases. So, come now, tell me this and give me an accurate answer. Where were you driven off your course? What countries peopled by men you came to? The men themselves and their strong-founded cities, and which were savage and violent, and without justice, and which were hospitable, and with a godly mind for strangers. And tell me, why you weep in your heart and make lamentation when you hear of the Argives and of the Danans' venture, and hear of Ilion? The gods did this, and spun the destruction of peoples for the sake of the singing of men hereafter. Was there perhaps some kinsman by marriage, wife's father or brother, a brave man who perished before Ilion? All right, the king says, maybe somebody you're related to by marriage, or your wife's father or your wife's brother. Is there somebody you know who died at Troy? Such are the relatives who, next to a man's own blood and kin, come closest to him? Or could it then have been some companion, a brave man knowing thoughts gracious toward you? Since one who is your companion and has thoughts honorable toward you is of no less degree than a brother? And thus we end Book 8 with the question of King Alcinous still unanswered.